Well, let's talk about you, and then we'll work up to the oldest living Confederate widow tells all. You were born in Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
That's right.
What was that like? What was life like as you grew up in North Carolina?
It was a town of 24,000. My mother was a retired school teacher. My father ran a grocery store and had some rental properties. My grandfather had a farm. It was on a major railroad connection. And I think it's the perfect place for a writer to grow up. I think small-town life qualifies a person to write a novel better than almost anything. It's a kind of party line all the time, and I think novels are about communities and how people affect each other, not only in terms of if I throw my garbage over the fence into your backyard, you're not happy, but how an act that's performed even 100 years ago can change and have an impact on people who are living now. In Manhattan, which I'm absolutely adore, it's my new favorite hometown, having started out in another. If I ran out into the street, for instance, and threw a Coca-Cola in somebody's face and ran off quickly enough, they would never find me. But if I did the same thing in Rocky Mount, phones would ring off the hook, ministers would be summoned, and it would be a family scandal on a major sort because all my cousins would have to take responsibility for it.
And the police chief might sit down with your dad.
Absolutely. That's right. His golf partner.
Yeah, right? That's right.
And work it out. Yeah. But it's a wonderful place to start. I feel in some ways that I had to leave it in order to write about it properly. I think it's very hard to see the place you were born until you've stepped out of it and have a sense of it as a circle, as something you've left behind. And I think that the things that irritated me most when I was growing up, the lack of privacy, the judgmental qualities, look more balanced and less terrible as I step away from it. There's a kind of bargain that you make with small towns that when somebody dies in your family, you get 35 casseroles immediately. And in exchange for this, you have to bake 35 casseroles in order to give back the dishes that the casseroles came in. But there's a kind of comfort. That's the way it works.
You have to return the dish filled?
They come with a little piece of, this is very codified tribal behavior here. They come with a piece of freezer tape with the name of the donor on the side so that you have to return the plate. So you don't get nothing for nothing.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
No, I wouldn't say it was literary. It was a household that very much respected education. It was a kind of household with three sets of encyclopedias, and whenever a child asked a basic question, the answer was, look it up! That's what the encyclopedias are for. But it was a household where learning was respected, and we were encouraged to draw and express ourselves in any way that did not destroy the furniture, you know, that sort of thing.
So, did you have any inkling that you might turn out to be a writer someday?
I started out as a painter, and I had a lot of luck, and I also had a lot of facility in drawing when I was a child, and had a one-man show when I was 12, which sold out. So I began, one of the ways I made my living or my candy money when I was a kid was selling paintings. So it's not that big a change from being a 12-year-old with oil paintings in the Holiday Inn restaurant to being in New York and selling novels. It's sort of a continuous line.
You went on to college. Where?
I went to my education was interrupted by the war in Vietnam. I started at art school at the University of Pennsylvania and the Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia, where I worked with Jack Levine and Franklin Watkins and some other wonderful painters. Then I stopped school, and the draft came for me. This would have been 66, before the American middle class understood that the war in Vietnam was a mistake and was very much for the war. And I was on the brink of being tried for draft evasion in my home county in North Carolina.
Did you declare yourself a conscientious objector?
I tried to. There'd never been a conscientious objector in Edgecombe County before in the history of the world. And so not knowing what to do with my files, they filed it in a circular file, the trash can, twice, so I had to. I tried with two applications, which failed, and at the 11th hour was told that I could either join the military or stand trial for draft evasion with a penalty of 6 years in federal penitentiary.
Is this the local draft board that
told you this? That's right. Mm-hmm. So I joined the Navy to get out of going to jail. I knew that if I went into jail at the age of 18, I would come out either a hardened criminal or somebody's sweetheart. I didn't know which, but I didn't like the prospect. So
I didn't know conscientious objectors were jailed. I thought there were other things that, for example, public service.
But
your
application for a conscientious objector can be denied, and that's what happened, essentially. Mm-hmm. I was not granted the standing because I was not a Quaker. I was doing it on ethical as opposed to religious grounds. And so I wound up on an aircraft carrier with 4,000 other guys, and that's where I really started reading seriously for the first time.
You have a library on board?
A quite good library, and a wonderful librarian who managed to get a hold of any book I wanted, which had flown on board in helicopters. So I had an extraordinary education at the expense of the federal government, which I thought was just a fairly even trade, except I think they got the better deal. And I read 1,200 books when I was in the Navy for 3.5 years and read them thoroughly. Just the way Malcolm X was sent to jail and educated himself in the library, I think a lot of people find that the military was a kind of stepping out of their lives into a kind of cell where they could concentrate and clear their minds. You didn't have to worry about what to put on in the morning. You had the uniform. Your head was shaved. You didn't have to worry about brushing your hair. So I was freed up to investigate, and I got terribly excited about literature and the possibility of applying myself to imitate the great works that I'd read. I mean, and that's the way I started as a painter. I would look at Cézanne, and I would sit down with my little 595 oil paint, and I would try to do a Cézanne, and I tried very hard to do a Henry James paragraph and a Proust paragraph and a Dickens paragraph, and that was my own self-taught attempt at learning how to write.
There's the story about Marilyn Monroe. She was decided to educate herself by reading the classics from A to Z, but only got up to L.
That's funny. Maybe that's where I stopped. The curious thing, I don't think this is talked about enough, Don, is that one reason people write, and I think one reason people do everything that they do, is to repay the pleasures that they've been given by other people in the same field. I mean, I don't know what your history with radio was as a child, but there's a way in which having been moved or having been enlarged by something when you're a kid, you feel a kind of ethical responsibility to pay it back. And one reason I've been teaching for the last 15 years to make a living is to repay the 5 or 6 great teachers. And I did have 5 or 6, which out of a lifetime is an enormous number. Usually people are lucky to have one. And also to repay to literature all the hours and hundreds of thousands of hours of pleasure I've had in reading other people's books. You want to repay in kind. So you try to write a book that is precisely the kind of book you would like to read. And it partakes of all the books you've read that you've loved and also has the benefit and merit of being your own at the same time.
It's an interesting concept. I never thought about it. Now.
I try to pay my bills. I've been applying for credit cards for many years now. Even Sears turned me down as of 2 years ago. I finally got an American Express card. At first I wrote that I was a writer, and they refused me out of hand. Having read French, German, English literature did not qualify me for equity. But when I applied the last time, I wrote corporate president as my occupation. I got one by return mail. I figured this is the vigilante action of a fiction writer. I hope the American Express people aren't listening, but I've been paying my bills, and I think that one of the things that I've tried to do in the book is to pay my bill, to return the favor, as it were.
What happened after the Navy?
I read while I was in the Navy works by John Cheever and Grace Paley, who are two writers who excited me very, very much. And I had the great good fortune of studying with both people. I went to Sarah Lawrence, which was the only college in the world that I know of that gave me 2 years academic credit for those 1,200 books I read on the aircraft carrier. So I got a BA in 2 years, and the last of those years I studied with Grace Paley, who was
at Sarah Lawrence.
At Sarah Lawrence, who was as a person as dimensional and ethically involved and brilliant as her prose is, and I benefited enormously from her presence and her suggestions. And then I graduated from Sarah Lawrence and went to the Writers' Workshop at Iowa, where I worked with John Cheever, Stanley Elkin, and John Irving, among others, all of whom gave me a great deal. And that,
well, by the time you got to Sarah Lawrence, there was no doubt about what you wanted to do.
I was pretty sure. I was working very hard to try to figure out what it was I had in terms of subject matter, and it was then that I began to understand what a blessing it is to be born in the provinces, the material that I had available to me in terms of black people and white people, not a single community, but the way those two communities exist simultaneously in the South, I found enormously powerful, and I felt very lucky. And I also began to examine certain things about my own past that I had taken for granted, one of which was being the great-great-grandson of slave owners. Though I'm not from a rich family by any means, it was necessary if you had a farm of over 100 acres in the 19th century to have some help. And if, in those days, you didn't hire help, you bought help. You went to Fayetteville and you paid $600 to $2,000 for a person, depending on what their skills were. If they could shoe horses and make shoes or were expert carpenters, their rates went up. So that I suddenly realized that there were people in my hometown with my same last name who were black people, and that the reason we shared the listing in the phone book was precisely that my great-great-grandparents had owned their great-great-grandparents.
Yeah, you write in an essay in the publicity material about browsing in a Carnegie library in California, I believe, and coming across a ledger with the name Gurganus in there, listing the property on that farm. Were you sure these people were related to you?
That's right. Well, the name is peculiar enough so that I'm the only Gurganus in the Manhattan phone book.
And what kind of, it sounds almost
Greek. I think it's Lithuanian. It's very hard to trace. The ledger you refer to is the 1790 census, and there was a single progenitor in Wilmington County who took the biblical phrase "go forth and multiply" very seriously indeed, and boy did he ever. So we're all derived from that old bent root back in Wilmington County, so that it's fairly easy to trace with a name this peculiar where in fact your ancestors were at a given time.
Well, coming to the North, studying at the University of Iowa, or the Iowa Writers' Workshop, knowing that you wanted to be a writer, you began to write short stories.
That's right.
Didn't I read someplace that Cheever was instrumental in having your first story published?
That's right. I was working with him at Iowa and wrote a story called Minor Heroism. Without my knowing it, Cheever sent the story to William Maxwell, the wonderful novelist, and who was then working as an editor at The New Yorker. I was living in a $60 a month room at the back of a Victorian mansion at the former kitchen, and sharing a bathroom with three other undergraduates. And the telephone rang. I actually had a telephone. And William Maxwell, in his wonderful, beautiful, soft voice, said, "This is William Maxwell, The New Yorker. I have some good news for you. I think we've just bought your story, Minor Heroism, for the November issue." And I said, "Yeah, and I'm Mae West, sure, absolutely." He laughed and said, "No, I promise you, this is real. John sent the story." So I was suddenly confronted with this astonishing fact that the first serious story I had written, and it was not a story that came easily, it was a story I had worked on for a year. And when you work on a 35-page story for a year, you know every word of the story. I can still quote the opening lines from the story. So that it was a very important and amazing fact that my first story had been placed in The New Yorker. Alas, it was the last thing they had bought. That was in 1974, so it was not necessarily a harbinger of great things to come. But they paid me a great deal of money, and I immediately spent the summer in Europe. I went over on the France. I bought wonderful clothes in Florence. I traveled around first class. I had a marvelous time, assuming that this was just going to be the first installment on a long and lucrative career. Well, lean times were ahead, but thank God I didn't know that at the moment. I would have saved it and wasted it on yogurt and notebook paper and things like that. I had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Well, writing is not known for being a highly paid craft, though, is it?
No, I've been living on $12,000 to $15,000 a year and whatever else I could eke out in terms of grants and advances and magazine sales. It's a kind of priesthood. It really, there's a certain point where we separate the men from the boys or the girls from the women, and I see my own graduate students decide at a certain point whether they have the stamina it takes to sit in a room for 20 years and write stories that might or might not move and amuse other people, that might or might not get placed, even if they do move and amuse other people. And what one finds is finally the rewards for the occupation become so eventual. I mean, here I am, 42 years old. This is my first book. I've waited until I thought I had a book that was a real book and that honored those books that I'd read before. You find that the reward for the occupation is the occupation. That just the way a dreamer interrupted in dreaming, if you wake a person up with electrodes when their eyelids start to move while they're dreaming and you refuse to allow them to dream for 6 days, they become psychotic within 2 weeks. Dreaming is a necessary balancing act for the psyche. And if you do writing 6 days a week for 20 years, it becomes as necessary as inhale, exhale. It becomes your way of moving through the world, your way of perceiving, your way of compensating for wounds that you receive, for fantasizing about what you want from the world. A kind of idea of justice in the world can be had on the page that can't necessarily always pertain in your own life.
But what happens if everything you write is rejected? I'm an amateur writer, and everything I've sent out comes back, or never comes back. I never hear about it again. Everything has been... I did a little novel last year. It's mm-hmm. not only half of a novel, really. It was published by St. Martin's Press, and it wasn't very good. It wasn't even a literary novel, but everything else is just rejected. And after a while, you begin to think, why should I keep doing this?
It's very, very hard. I think the only reason people keep doing it is because they can't not keep doing it. And I think that it's a curious thing. You know, my book is getting a certain amount of attention, and it automatically becomes a foregone conclusion that I was a proven quantity all my life. What people don't understand is that every writer who's sending out material has to deal with, since 1974 when I started publishing, I've had 1 to 3 rejection slips a week. My mail is bills and rejection slips mostly, and the good luck that's befallen me at the end of 20 years doesn't make me forget that. I mean, there are people who are ready and willing to forget their pain and how much it's cost them, and I'm not one of them. I want to remember that, partly because I think that's really the subject of fiction. I mean, somebody has said, all stories can be boiled down to this line, and then something went terribly, terribly wrong. Once upon a time, a princess couldn't laugh, and blank. So that you fill in the blank. It's the subject of fiction is trouble. And the problem with becoming a successful writer, it seems to me, the jeopardy that's involved, is precisely that you forget what trouble is. I can think of writers who wrote brilliantly when they were 25 until they became famous and then lost their subject matter, lost their people, lost their tie to the world, and began writing about the trauma of their first novel in the intellectual community and how to spend their advance. That's not interesting to most people. It does not interest me.
Yeah, I'm doing an interview tomorrow with an author of a biography of Reuben Shaw, and Shaw was a highly regarded literary writer for his early years, and then all of a sudden he became what they call a commercial writer with stories that were somewhat contrived and characters that were contrived, and lost a lot of the credibility he had. But he became extraordinarily wealthy, so that he had a chalet in Switzerland, and maybe the trade-off was worth it. I don't know. It's...
I think everybody has to make their own decision about that. But having done without for 20 years, I don't intend to give up what I've won. I mean, character for me is not only essential in my fiction, it's essential in my address book. I'm only interested in people who are involved in some kind of mission in their life, who see their life as the grounds for a kind of heroism. I'm interested in people who see themselves as their own main character of their lives, and a lot of people don't. One of the things that drew me to the subject matter of my novel was to try to imagine how it is that people survive, to imagine the worst things that could happen to a person, and to conceive of how those things could be transcended. One of the lines that my heroine uses is, "She who laughs lasts." And it's a sort of a tongue twister, but it makes a certain amount of sense when you think about it. And I think those of us who don't take ourselves too seriously, who don't think that our suffering and pain is unique in the universe, but see that it's part of everybody else's suffering and pain, and that we're a community in trouble, not just an individual with back taxes and headaches.
Now, most people hide it, though. I mean, I look at other people, and they say, gosh, they don't have a trouble in the world. It's only me.
It's true.
Well, you were reading the newspaper one day, and you saw a reference to the oldest living Confederate widow. Tell me how this book came about.
Occasionally you hit a phrase, I think it happens to everybody, you hit a phrase that really speaks to you and seems destined for you. I read a piece in the Times 8 years ago that said there were 29 women on the Mississippi payroll as widows of Confederate soldiers. Now, this sounds physically impossible and time impossible, but it's not. These were women who were born in 1885, for example, at the age of 15 in 1900, married men in their 50s, 60s, or 70s, and partly to take advantage of the pension, which had been granted by the U.S. Congress, not only to Northern veterans, but to Southern veterans 20 years after the struggle. Something about the phrase itself, oldest living Confederate widow, set off every alarm in my head. I just thought, holy moly, here is something remarkable. At this point, I'd been living out of the South for some years. I'd been in New York for 4 years. I was beginning to have that distance on my hometown and on my own circumstance that I spoke of earlier. And the perspective that I needed to write about the South, and more than the South, to write about the struggle of how to stay sane, the struggle of how to survive, was all in that phrase. I love the titles that begin with the last. There's a great Richard Bausch novel called The Last Good Time. I love the Walker Percy, The Last Gentleman, and I can conceive of novels in the future called The Last Hippie, or The Last Wasp, or The Last Rolling Stone Alive, or something like that. So I suddenly had a voice in my head, instantaneously on reading the article. I galloped up to my room and typed for 4 hours, right through dinner. It's very unusual for me to miss a meal, so I knew I was onto something. And what I had at the end was the 30 pages that begin the book, the shooting at the watering hole of a 13-year-old Confederate soldier by a Northern sniper. But more importantly, even than that, I had the voice of Lucy Marsden. I knew that I was on to something when my friends who read those first 30 pages, and I sent them through the mail, wrote back saying, "How is Lucy?" They didn't say, "How is your new project? How is the book?" They began asking about her as if she were my adored grandmother or my favorite great aunt. So suddenly I felt, this is a living person. You've somehow contacted a force that's as alive as you, if not more so, and three times smarter, because though Lucy has a fifth grade education and lives in a small town, she knows things that I didn't know until I wrote them down in her voice. On the best days, it's like taking dictation from somebody who is infinitely more dimensional and humorous and colorful than you are. And it's just a matter of honoring those pages and refining them and shaping them until not only has she presented her own story, but she has presented the stories of 40 other major characters, and crucially, not only white characters, but black characters as well.
It seems to me that you had three different hurdles to overcome. One, adopting Lucy's voice and maintaining it accurately through the book, to the technical aspects of writing a book, the structure of it, and making the words flow. And third, you obviously just didn't pull this out of your head. I mean, there's research that had to be done so that you would know the battles and know the issues and the politics and the conditions of that time. So that this was a tremendous project right from the outset, wasn't it?
It was. It was enormous. I wanted very much to write a book that was completely accurate historically without being pedantic. I think that there's nothing more boring than an expert who will stop the action to say, little did they know that day in 1863 that advancing from the north in a force of 1,200 came General Johnson with his... I mean, it's deadly. And it's not the way we talk to each other personally. I mean, we have history behind us, but we only use those aspects of history that pertain directly to us. So I wanted to know more than my heroine knew, but not so much more that I became a bore about it. What I discovered in the course of the research was storehouses of material, because the American Civil War is studied not only in American schools, but it's considered the quintessential Civil War, and it's studied in France and Germany, and it's a pure and perfect and terrifying example of a civil war. I learned facts that were so beautiful and so transcendent that I felt I could not improve upon them. There's a chapter set at Lee's surrender at Appomattox. I read in Shelby Foote's Narrative History of the Civil War that Lee had a uniform that was made for a victory celebration that was saved back and carried with him all the way through the war in a special garment sack. And of course he wore it instead to surrender. He got on his horse Traveler, who was pearl gray, as was his uniform, as was his beard, as was his hair. And Lee was on to six foot 3 inches tall, an enormous man on an enormous horse. He had to pass along a road where all his surrendered army was gathered. And he sent his minions ahead, and the men knew Lee was coming, and the men understood what Lee was going to do. And the men regretted it, but they had such respect for him that they acquiesced. But each of them felt tremendously involved and tremendously moved after this enormous struggle. Many of them were suffering from scurvy. Many of them had lost limbs. Many of them were dead or dying. And yet they all wanted to commemorate his presence. I imagine in my book that the best speech maker in each division perfected a speech to give to Lee as he moved along the road. But in fact, the men found themselves speechless. They couldn't sing, they couldn't hip hurrah. And so spontaneously, history tells us, they drew into the center of the road, and as Lee walked on the horse toward General Grant, they took off their hats and held their hats out so that the hats passed over the forelocks of Lee's horse and over Lee's legs and boots and over the rump of the horse and over the tail of the horse, so that Lee rode for miles and miles through this row of double hats. Now, I couldn't in a million years invent anything that good. I pride myself on being able to take random facts and make something that's just perverse and crazy enough to have actually happened. But I can tell you, Don, that if I work 1,000 years at writing, I will never come up with anything that good. And part of the beauty of research is not finding facts which you then tart up like Laura Ashley and tie bows around them and try to make them yours, but in fact of honoring the facts of history that are bigger and better than you are. So I was given an enormous number of beautiful gifts by the research that I did.
Well, you spent 7 years writing. Tell me about the actual process of writing. You sit at a typewriter every day and work 8 hours, or do you work in a spontaneous way and then not do anything for another 2 weeks, or what?
I can't. I need to work every day. I need to feel that I work as hard as my father works. This is what we do if we grew up in a workaholic family. If you're an artist and your parents work enormously hard, then by God, you do too, to prove that what you're doing is just as valid. My schedule is pretty rigid. I get up at 6:30. I have a decent breakfast. I'm a great believer in breakfast. I have 2 cups of intense French-Italian espresso from Zabar's, $3.98 a pound. Wonderful. I've made them a fortune just by juking myself up in the morning. And then I go to work in an apartment which is filled with family things and books and junk and a mass collection and things that I find entertaining to live with and look at. And I work until 1:30 in the afternoon when I plug in my phone and go and do my banking and my grocery chores, and then I see friends or movies or plays or go out and visit in the evening. And this has been my ideal schedule. I don't like to go out of the house until I've done 4 or 5 hours' work. And the beauty of this is that if you have a bad day, the way everybody on every job has a bad day, you're not thrown off so much that you can't get up the next day and face it again. If you wait for inspiration, you can wait a long time. Everybody I sit next to on an airplane tells me they've got a great idea for a novel, and all they need is 6 weeks in a cabin in the mountains to do it. But they'll tell me the idea, and I'll write it, and then we'll split the profits 50-50. It don't work that way.
Well, I've talked to some writers who say, well, I write an hour a day. I write a page a day. I write a page a day at the end of the year, you know, I have a novel. Well, I could look at the screen of my word processor and nothing will come. I mean, I could look at it for 2 hours and not get one page, then have to come to work. But there may be some days that you wrote first 30 pages in 4 hours. Sometimes it just
flows.
That's right.
There are gifts. And you have to be, the doctor is in sign has to be hanging up there so inspiration feels that there's somebody to see her. I think that there's something to be said for regularity. Tennessee Williams says that dogs and children and writers hate surprises. And the curious thing is that, as Flaubert puts it, you need to live like a bourgeois in order to write like a radical. And I'm a great habitual person. I like to have the same pair of slippers. When one wears out, I want the same kind of slippers, and the same is true.
I'm the same way, and I hate to have anything out of place. If I go to get my comb and it's not there, you know, I go into a fit. Sometimes it's my own fault, but, What happens now? Here's this wonderful, marvelous book and rave reviews, your first book. This is certainly not going to be the end of Alan Garganis.
Well, I hope not. I think not. I think it's just the beginning. I mean, the curious thing about writing is there's an enormously long apprenticeship for a novelist. Since novels are all about people in time and how time changes them or doesn't, you have to have a certain number of years under your belt in order to see time's movements, and that includes losing people to time. When I was 21, I had not lost anybody except grandparents. And now at 42, having lived in New York for the last 8 years during the AIDS epidemic, I've lost an enormous number of dear friends. And all this has gone into the book. I know what it is to be an old person because I've lost so many friends. And all this has informed the fiction. My ambition is just to write other books. I don't want to write the screenplay for the movie. I don't want to change apartments. I don't want to do anything different, including change bedroom slippers or Zabar's coffee. I want to stay home. I want to take care of my business. I want to pay my bills. And I want to write other books that will bring readers to them by virtue of their having read the first book, so that if I put my name on the cover of a book, it is a guarantee to the people who read that the book is funny and serious in equal measures, and that it's enjoyable, and that their wants and needs and interests have been considered. I'm very interested in my reader, and just as when I invite people to my house, I make sure I have something to drink and something to eat and something to sit on. I feel the same is true of prose. I think one of the tragedies of American fiction in the last 15 years is that the reader has been given short shrift, that minimalism has done minimal duties as a host to readership, and that people who are starved for narrative, which is everybody I know, people love stories, people love to feel continuous connections between characters, have turned away from literature and have turned to things like Dynasty and Dallas, I mean, and soap operas and The Telephone. But for me, the great novels are still the great 19th century novels. And I don't think it's an exhausted form at all. I think it's like putting new wine in an old bottle. It's the wine is new, and the meaning of the novel for me is as fresh as if I just read my first one yesterday.
Do you still have a commitment to Sarah Lawrence?
I'm still on at least listed on the teaching list at Sarah Lawrence, and I feel enormously dedicated to the place and grateful to the place, having taught there for 10 years now and having been a student there. What I would really like to do most, I think, is see what it is like to stay at home and write for a while, full-time.
And well, this may help to give you the freedom to do that.
I hope so.
It must be liberating to...
It's very invigorating, and I've learned an enormous amount from teaching. It's a cliche to say that you learn more from your students than you teach them. But in fact, being around 19 and 20-year-old kids who believe passionately in literature and in the possibility of their own writing is so invigorating and so renewing. And I think it's one reason teachers stay young and teachers stay alive to the world. I prefer that to having lunches with cynical New York editors. I have made a policy when I moved to New York that I would never eat lunch out, and I've pretty much kept that bargain.
Not even a free one?
Not even a free one. Those are the only ones that interest me. Are you kidding? So it's also good for the waistline to skip lunch, but it's better for the spirit, because I'd rather be with true believers who are 19 than I would with cynics of 50 who've seen it all and done it all and feel that they've given up on the idea of literature. It's one of the things that's kept me coming back for more.
Well, Alan Gerganis, this is an absolutely marvelous book, but a terrific start. And we say start, you know, and you're not even an amateur. I mean, you started years ago, but it's a wonderful book. And I can say this in unison with all the other critics that I've seen. Everybody seems to love this book. Congratulations to you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.